From Studio H3 in the Current Affairs World Headquarters, it's Current Affairs, your ears' greatest hour of politics and culture. Tonight on the program, we unpack productivity culture and we retire some overused political buzzwords. Our panel tonight, Current Affairs Senior Editor Brianna Renix.
Hello, everyone.
Current Affairs Finance Editor Sparky Abraham.
Hi.
Current Affairs Podmaster General Ashling McRae.
Hello.
Current Affairs Business Manager Eli Massey.
Howdy.
And I'm your host, with a slight sore throat, Pete Davis. We begin with segment one, is this good or bad? In the recurring segment, is this good or bad? Previously titled Manichaean Monster Mash, we assess whether a cultural phenomenon is good or bad, or of course, a bit of both. Though that's rare. This week's topic, productivity culture. It's all around us. Self-improvement, self-help, the 7 habits of highly effective people, life hacking, the Pomodoro method, task management software, running triathlons, juice cleanses, bullet journaling, bullet coffee, biphasic sleep, sending Google Calendar invites for hanging out with your friends, Evernote, Soylent, Fitbits, the quantified self, SoulCycle, protein shakes, optimizing yourself so as to, through some mystical feat of efficiency, transcend our inevitable death, Trello boards, making your bed, you know, all that jazz. Productivity culture. Panel tonight, we ask, is this good or bad?
My favorite thing to have happened on this podcast so far was that.
That was a marathon.
I read some blogs to prepare that list. There were worse things on there, but they were too dark to read out. Biphasic sleep is pretty disturbing. Before we get into if this is good or bad, the normative judgment, let's unpack the objective assessment. What do we think is even going on here with productivity culture? We seem to be on like year 15 of it. It started around like the 2000s when everyone was like into TED Talks in Silicon Valley. Do you agree with me that that's when this started? Is this a single phenomenon or am I piling multiple into one? Does anyone here have a story of their experience with productivity culture? So let's unpack this first and then we'll get towards our judgment. As the title of the panel suggests, is this good or bad?
I think there's probably aspects of it that have always been a thing. You can probably go back to some of those old, like, Victorian pharmaceutical ads where they have all those brain tonics that are just cocaine and alcohol. So probably there's always been that tendency, or at least sort of post-industrial revolution, I guess, to kind of be the best that you can be. But I think probably the internet makes it more, it's more of a performance, right? Because you have the sort of the Instagram thing and the LinkedIn thing of, you know, I just had a baby 4 weeks ago and I've started 2 businesses. What's your excuse? Like, it's very kind of showing that you are the person who is doing all the things. So I think probably, yeah, the internet has been a big sparker of phenomenon.
There were enforced productivity culture through Frederick Taylorism in the like assembly line where they used to like analyze if you were like hitting the nail at like 1.2 seconds versus 1.1 second or something. So
versus now they just analyze how long you spend in the bathroom.
Yes, it's very dark. But the weird thing is that it's kind of productivity culture. There's like a precarious work version of that, like, are you driving your Ubers or picking your Amazon warehouse fast enough? But the weird phenomenon is also that there's this white collar self-imposed productivity culture of like people wanting to optimize themselves to start their own business or something.
I mean, I don't think impressing people is necessarily like anything new, right? Like, it may be one of these things that the internet gives us new ways of doing and new access to at all times as opposed to only sometimes. I think like one of the interesting things about productivity culture, at least right now, maybe this has always been true, is the sort of countervailing push for the self-care. We had an article, a really good article. Wait, Ashling, was that your article?
The self-care one? Yeah.
The self-care one? Yeah, that was your article. Yeah, that was great, about sort of like self-care culture, which I just, it then itself becomes performative. Like the performative self-care thing just really, I think it's a species of self-improvement and productivity culture, and it's just so very confusing to me. I can't tell if are we supposed to be caring for ourselves in order to be more productive.
Sparky, you say countervailing, and I wonder if you could explain why you think like the self-care movement is like a counterbalance to the productivity. Because I feel like it's kind of part and parcel of the drive to be more efficient. You know, employers love to promote self-care because it means more efficient workers.
Well, I think that, you know, people mean a gajillion things by everything they say.
Right, right.
There's definitely a species of self-care that's like that. But then there's the other species of self-care that's like, I've been working really hard. I'm going to like, you know, watch 6 hours of TV and eat a pint of ice cream and because like hashtag self-care, which I don't think is part of productivity. It's something else.
There's this German theologian named Joseph Pieper that I'm obsessed with from, I think it was in the 30s or something, or possibly a little later. And he wrote this book called Leisure, the Basis of Culture, where he wanted to center society on leisure, not on work. And he had this kind of rant about leisure should not exist for the sake of recharging you for work. Leisure should exist as a co-equal part of life, and perhaps even subsuming work to the point that you have a leisurely attitude towards life, where when you're doing work, it's with the process of leisure. But a lot of this self-care stuff sometimes becomes, you know, let's prepare ourselves for more work.
Pete, will you start a theology podcast called Jeepers Peepers? Will you commit to doing that right here, right now, in all your free time?
I will take that pledge.
Okay, good.
I still feel like this is really big. Like, I'm not sure what exactly we're talking about.
Yeah, can I ask a quick question? Why are we lumping together self-improvement and productivity culture into one heading? Because those don't seem like the same thing to me, but maybe I don't understand, like, what the specific context of self-improvement is here.
Yeah, so Tim Ferriss is at the center of it all. Which is like the guy who wrote 4-Hour Work Week, and he has like millions of followers. Okay. Joe Rogan and Tim Ferriss. And then when you buy these airport books that are like how to be a boss or something, like they're all like blurbed by Tim Ferriss, who's this guy who wrote this book called 4-Hour Work Week and then wrote 4-Hour Body. And what he does is he does these experiments in like, I took like these sets of chemicals and like this was the one that allowed me to like get the most done in 2 hours or something. Or like what I use, like the Pomodoro method, is like you have this egg timer and it's like 25 minutes of work and then 5 minutes of rest, and then you set it again and it's 25 minutes of work and then 5 minutes of rest. And so there's this certain culture that's kind of associated with these Silicon Valley people. They usually all clump together. It's like they're into the singularity, Andrew Yang, Bitcoin, you know, and productivity culture. And then they all have their like efficient email signatures that tell them like how to contact them. And then they use like their task management software. And then this way they do this. And is that different than like the culture of self-improvement that's like, we should get rock hard abs? Is that different than like the productivity culture of like a boss forcing you to work more? Like, what are these connected?
So. Okay, so we're not talking about like moral self-improvement here at all.
This is a great pre-autoretics question. Yeah, so self-improvement in the like Jesuit.
I assumed when I saw self-improvement, we were talking about how to be better people, but that's fine. We could talk about abs instead.
Well, that's a really great point you're bringing up, which is the culture of self-improvement. Like if you ask someone in the 1800s or the 1600s, it would be like, or like Ben Franklin, it would be like, reflect on ways you were bad in the past year and like how you could be a better person. It's not usually about how to get more work done in an 8-hour day.
I think kind of part of why I would kind of lump those two together is because I think self-improvement now, it's very much, even when it's not about work, it's kind of approaching it in the same way that you would approach work. So it might be for things like, oh, I want to learn Italian, or I want to go to the gym more, or I want to, you know, do this hobby or whatever, or I want to sleep in the most efficient way. But it's kind of weird the way that we approach it now is everything seems to be with that sort of goal in mind. It's a very sort of work-based approach, even to your leisure, I think, which worries me.
I mean, I think a lot of it is very utilitarian and kind of utility maximizing. And I'm reminded of my favorite book by Barbara Ehrenreich called Bright Sided. And just as an aside, Lida recently interviewed Barbara Ehrenreich, and I urge everyone to listen to the interview because it's really, really excellent. So anyway, in Bright Sided, Barbara Ehrenreich pretty satisfyingly flays positive thinking in all the many forms it takes. So the book came out in like 2009. It was right on the heels of the Wall Street crisis. And she was talking about how optimism and positive thinking played a role there and self-delusion. She was inspired to write the book after being diagnosed with breast cancer. And at one point, she talks about hanging out on an online cancer discussion forum. And one user scolds her and tells her something like, if you don't get a better, more positive attitude, you're going to die and it's going to be your fault. So I think self-care kind of often functions in a similar way. Like if you're depressed or sick or tired, it's your fault, you know? Anyway, yeah, I think positive thinking, like the whole positive thinking movement seems at least like a cousin to all of this and feels sort of similar or related.
But it's also, I don't really know how to think about this. And I think this point kind of applies more broadly too. But like, there's a sense in which all of this is bullshit. Right? Like all the efficiency maximizing stuff is bullshit. All the positive thinking stuff is bullshit. Like The Secret is obviously bullshit. And I was waiting for Pete to mention The Secret. I love The Secret.
I actually, there is an interesting thing about The Secret, which is that a lot of this is gendered.
Yeah.
And I listed a lot of like, I don't know if this is wrong to say, but like stereotypically male self-improvement things. But there's also like a stereotypically feminine, female like self-improvement things that are like The Secret versus like taking protein whey shakes or something.
Right. Or like Tools of the Titans, right?
You're
Tool
of the Titans, which is a Tim Ferriss book.
The dude reads Tools of the Titans and like the,
It's great that it's like all the same stuff though, pretty much. Like, if you read like, because I remember like Nathan and I did that article on Mike Cernovich like a few years ago. If you read his stuff, like it's indistinguishable from like any like self-help book for women, except there's like some stuff about lifting in there. Like, it's great. Right. So, it's all the same.
So I guess this is the thing. And I think this kind of links up to politics too. Is like, you know, if you're going to come in and be rational and be realistic and like look at the world, you kind of go, this stuff's all bullshit. You know, people are basically like stuck in whatever situation they're stuck in. Like we're all in a lot of ways impotent. But it's almost like having that little bit of hope in the possibility of self-improvement or the possibility of political improvement is like a necessary but not a sufficient condition to actually having a better life or a better society. And you see, like, it really does help people. Like, I don't want to call him out because I think he listens to this podcast sometimes, but I have like a friend who, you know, like we kind of switched off bedrooms that we were living in for a little while. And at one point, like, I just found like this nice, like a little folded up piece of paper that he had like stashed in the desk that had like five affirmations on it for him to like read to himself every day. It was like, you know, in, kind of in a spot in the desk where he could get it every day. You know, it was just like very like, oh, like be grateful, like, you know, tell people you love them. Just like, you know, and like, you're doing great, like, stay on your hustle, you know, this kind of thing. But, like, that really is the kind of thing that helps him, and, like, looking at that stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of these books are the same way, where it's like, you know, even if they're claiming that something is empirically true that's not true, or they're telling you that things are possible that aren't possible, like, just the process of reading something affirming, like, having some hope for yourself, again, it might not actually give you the power to do the thing that you want to do or even to improve at all, but at least it's sometimes a necessary condition for having that. You have to think that it is possible in order for things to be possible.
Yeah, I mean, like, who doesn't want to have, like, more hope about their work and also get more stuff done at work? Like, everyone, right? Like, it's a totally reasonable thing to want. If there was a magical method that could let me get more stuff done at work, I would love to know what that is.
Yeah, you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater because it is really important to improve yourself because you start off as a baby, as I understand it, and then you become like
everyone who's grown beyond a baby has improved themselves a lot.
Yes.
It's like, babies are terrible.
Congratulations, you're taller.
Talk about becoming a more moral person, though.
Yes.
Babies are pretty moral. I don't know.
Babies are the most self-improving creature in the world.
You don't think babies are moral?
No, babies are sociopaths.
This is a totally different podcast segment should do.
Well, listen.
Moral. I would love that.
There's a psychologist Paul Bloom, who I may be mixing up two of his books, but I think he wrote a book called Just Babies, and it's about like babies' moral sense of the world. So that's something to check out.
Isn't this the Catholic idea of limbo, that if you like die before a certain age, they have to assess if you're worthy of sin?
No. It's about whether you're baptized or not, right? Like,
oh, it's pre-baptism.
It's babies who die without being baptized, so they can't go to heaven. But then the church was like, that's upsetting. We made that up. So it's not a thing anymore.
Maybe infants are not moral actors yet, but two-year-olds are definitely sociopaths, right? Sorry, anyway.
I hope we've all got better, both morally and in terms of, you know, living our lives and doing things better. I hope we've all improved in the last sort of 10, 15 years of our lives. And there are things that are useful. I always had problems with organization and remembering things, and now I use apps and to-do lists and all those things. So it's not like there's nothing to any sort of self-improvement, but it's more about, I suppose it's to what end, right? Like, it's all about, I suppose, keeping a perspective and thinking, you know, okay, if I need to, I want to, you know, go to the gym, or I want to do this hobby because it's going to make me feel better, and it's maybe it's going to instill some discipline. Like, I don't know, maybe Spuggy can comment better on this. I know that in martial arts, there tends to be a lot of people who are fans of particularly the more sort of masculine coded self-help stuff and the protein and the man pills and the whatever that stuff is.
Glad to be the resident man pill expert.
But it also, like, it gives you a sense of discipline and some big project to work on, and that's like, there is something good to that, and people find usefulness in that. So there's always a core of something in there, but it's just why and to what end, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, people need projects, right? Like, not having a project is a good recipe for exacerbating depression if you already have depression, or like maybe getting it if you don't. I guess the other kind of like personal contact that I'm feeling about this discussion is like, I remember when I was an early teenager, probably my dad was like really into The Secret, even despite the fact that it was that it's female coded, according to Pete.
I gave so many.
I know. You had all the caveats. If you hadn't had all the caveats, I wouldn't be making it.
I gave so many caveats.
He was like into The Secret, I think, in like what some people would have found a counterproductive way, where he was like basically relying on like envisioning a check just randomly coming in the mail to like save us. He's like, oh, if I just envision like this check coming in the mail hard enough, this is what's gonna like save us financially, like get us out of bankruptcy, get the house out of foreclosure. And of course the fucking check never came in the mail. But it's not like he really had anything that he could have done if he wasn't doing that, right? He was basically able to kind of like operate day to day, like in my memory at least, without being like in a deep, deep depression, thanks to this completely unreasonable, unrealistic hope that had nothing to do with reality. But I feel like that was probably good. I mean, it would obviously be better if you could realize that The Secret is bullshit and then go do something that would actually productively be a solution to your problems. But that was not going to happen. And I think this was like better than the alternative.
Well, that's the function that like religious faith fills for a lot of people who have like nothing that they can actually do to change their situations like at all. Like, is that like bad? I don't think so. Like, it's better than the alternative.
So I, you know, on the both totally stupid and on the deep level, I see the benefits. On the stupid level, like, I have this really good labeling system for my emails that I've like slowly developed over time, and it lets me get my emails done. And so like a certain productivity blog in the past like helped me do that. On the deep level, I also get...
Do you not want to name it?
No, I don't know. Oh, okay. Like, over time, just reading the stupid stuff, I've like developed a labeling system that's very efficient and brings me a tiny bit of joy every day. And like automatic filtering and forwarding, it's really good. Anyone DM me and I'll share. And on the deep level of like giving you things that give you hope about like getting better and things changing, I will share this story of like the bad side of this stuff, which is self-improvement teaching you that you can change, but the structure can never change, which is that like in the American psyche, the individual is infinitely fungible. You know, they can become a millionaire. You can become anything you dream, set your mind to it, but the institutions must never change. There's nothing we can do. Pie in the sky. Like Bernie's pie in the sky for thinking we can have free college, but telling a homeless person, you know, who hasn't like learned basic computer literacy yet, you could become a coder and become like Mark Zuckerberg. That's a reasonable thing to tell someone. That's like a structure versus agency kind of fungibility craziness. Also, I just want to caveat, you know, maybe they can. I want to believe everything's possible with everyone. But here's the story. So I met this kid in my town, and I was talking to him, and he didn't have a house. His family had kind of abandoned him, and he is kind of in the social services system that's like kind of surrounded being without a home in my town. And he was being told, you have to go work at these like three places that we place people who are like 25 and homeless in this town if they're like ready to improve. And it was like an Amazon warehouse. It was like working at Subway. and it was UPS, like low-level UPS loading the vans. And all of those jobs should, of course, be dignified for people who want to do those jobs. But I just talked to this kid for a while, and this kid's like an intellectual kid, and this kid loves the library. And this kid loves reading. And I said, do you know there are jobs at the library? Like, and he's like, oh my gosh, I love the library. And I'm like, yeah, you could be front desk at the library to get started or something. Or you're 25. Like, did you ever think about going to college? And he was like, well, no, like I was like filed as a bad kid in high school and they didn't even like bother helping me. And my family was too unstable to do this. And I'm like, oh, let's just go, I'll come with you and we'll go talk to the library and get you this library job. And let's start thinking like 25, you can start college later than usual and we can figure this out. And he was like, had never been told that before. He had only been told, get on your grind at the Amazon warehouse, you know? And he had it self-internalized that. And he's like, I just gotta work harder. I was bad last week. And I'm like, what do you mean you were bad last week? And he was like, I just didn't go to work one day. And I'm just so mad at myself. And I talked to my person at the social services place and they said, you gotta be better. And I'm like, yeah, I gotta be better. I gotta get back on my grind. I can't let that happen again. And I wanted to tell him, like, it's not all on you. Like, there are just alternate options. Like, maybe you don't want to work there, you know? And productivity culture and self-improvement culture had made him think any flaw of the experience that he had been filed in was like a moral failing of him. And I watched him talk with one of these social service people and they were filing it all under, that's not going to happen again where you don't go into work. And I was like, oh no, like this is limiting our horizon of possibilities and productivity culture is an agent in doing that. I don't know. Am I reading that wrong?
Did he get the job at the library?
We're still working on it.
Okay. Keep us updated.
We're going to keep pushing. And I want to caveat, like, going to college isn't the only option. And we're going to get the library is not the only option. Those should be dignified jobs at Amazon and Subway as well. But, like, productivity culture for some, you know, your dreams for others. You know, it's like we have to have equality in this, you know.
I mean, I do think that, like, it probably is, like, these kind of things work differently for different people. And I have no doubt that there are people who, like this is the thing, like one of the things that works for them. Like, I know a guy at the gym that I go to who basically is like, if I don't feel like going to the gym in the morning, like, am I really going to be able to look myself in the mirror later and be like, I was a weenie today? Like, no, I'm not going to be a weenie today. I'm going to go to the gym, right? That would never motivate me. Like, I just am fine with being a weenie all the time. But, you know, it, like, I feel like this stuff's really hard because you can't, you know, these are all tools to get, it's both a cause and an effect for so much stuff. And it's really hard to kind of write off like the get on your grind culture, which might actually be really helpful for some people in some circumstances, even though it's completely limiting to other people in other circumstances.
Well, I wanted to respond to that point and pick up on it a bit. I mean, listen, I think that there are definitely useful fictions that we tell ourselves to get up out of bed in the morning and keep on doing whatever it is we have to do. And I think that there's real value in that. And I'm reluctant to like scoff at people's source of motivation. But I also think that like, there's something very ersatz about it, like artificial, in that it presents or it prevents us from thinking systemically about what are the root causes of our problems and how we might go about like actually changing our material circumstances. I'll just give you a sort of example. Like about 2 years ago, my mom took like a bad fall while she was walking in downtown Chicago and she like broke and dislocated her shoulder. And, you know, she bruised her head and she was bleeding pretty badly. But she took public transit, like, almost all the way home, and I met her at the train to take her to the hospital, and she was in agonizing pain, but she refused to call an ambulance because they're so expensive, so we took an Uber. But the first 15 to 20 minutes before we called the Uber, we were trying to figure out which hospital to take her to that her insurance would actually cover. And real self-care would mean Medicare for all, you know? But you probably won't hear that in, like, Cosmo or Bon Appetit magazine or whatever. And I think that, like, you know, if you're thinking about self-care and that, like, the grind culture that you sort of described, that's useful maybe on, like, a personal, individual level in terms of, like, I hate this dead-end job, I'm working, but I need the money to pay my rent, I need the money to support my family. But in terms of actually changing the shittiness of your job and the shittiness of your, like, material circumstance in reality, it's going to do nothing for you.
I think it also, it even works against it because it often becomes this weird, like, anti-organizational thing where forming a union or organizing perversely becomes like a sign of weakness. Like, I don't need a union. Like, some of you might have seen on social media, someone posted, there was some place that was unionizing and someone put up a thing that was like, I'm a liberal and I support unions and I support labor rights. But
that place was Harvard.
Yeah. But it was like, I don't need to actually join the union to prove that. And it's so endemic, that idea that like joining a union is you trying to like prove some sort of point, or it's about your identity or your personality, or it's some sign that you can't do, like it's better to do things on your own rather than join a union. It's weird. So yeah, I think maybe
should we rebrand the left as collective self-care?
Yeah, maybe we should. Maybe you should use that self-help thing. We can make one of those books you buy in airports that's like, it can be, you know, business your way.
We should start a website called Collective Life Hacker. Mm. And it's like 8 simple tricks for reforming the financial system.
Well, so this is funny, but like the like asshole contrarian point that I wanted to make after Eli was talking was like, you know, stuff like that kind of starts to sound like productivity culture from the other direction. And like, yeah, maybe it's better, but if you're telling people constantly like you need to be thinking about your structure, you need to be trying to change your structure while you're trying to like make rent working in the Amazon, you like, you can't just do the thing that's going to get you through the day. You have to think about the broader circumstances.
No, I'm just saying if you want your circumstances to change, the only way you can do that is through collective organizing. If you're content, keep grinding, you know?
But, like, that's the exact same thing. Like, they're saying if you want your circumstances to change, the only way you can do that is through self-improvement. And you're like, the only way you can do that is through collective organizing. And, like, one of those things is more true than the other. Like, you're definitely more right than they are. But it's still, it's the same kind of thing.
Isn't that what matters?
I mean, it does matter, but it's also, like it has to connect to what actually helps people. And I think that the different things are going to help different people and depending on their circumstances. Like, there are definitely times in my life when I would have been like, fuck off, Eli. I don't know what that means.
Well, but there are better, like, you don't have to frame it in the way that I think what I'm saying is a basic truth about the world and power. And I think there are better or worse ways of framing it. If someone's down on their luck and in the shitter, I'm not going to tell them, like, you know, the only thing that you could do to improve your circumstances is organize around, you know, material. Like, that's so cerebral and unpersuasive and just, yeah, you're right. It's assholish and it's condescending and it doesn't sound good. Yeah, there are better and worse ways of organizing people, but that's not a strike against organizing, you know? Just because rhetorically it's unpersuasive in this moment, you know?
Sure.
Can I do a little plug? There's a podcast called Rebel Steps, and that's actually a podcast that when I heard of it, I was like, oh, I've been looking for someone to do this. Each episode is about like a small thing you can do, because the term organizing is so broad, and I think often people don't really know how to do it. So it's literally just a step of like, if there's a law being passed in your state you don't like, here's how you write a letter to your congressman, or here's how you do like this thing. So it's like little steps you can do. I'd recommend that podcast.
Another type of productivity, small steps towards the revolution. Let's go to break.
You've tried them all. Every subscription service in existence. So have we. And we tried really, really hard to dream up an original concept for a subscription box. And we're not going to lie, it was a challenge. There's a lot already out there. But in the end, we succeeded. We uncovered the one box that isn't yet available. The one subscription service you didn't even know you need. Spiders. That's right, spiders. Subscribe to Weber today, and every month we'll send you a secure, gift-wrapped package of up to 40,000 live, organic spiders. Imagine spiders on your Casper mattress, spiders in your kombucha, spiders in the bathroom cabinet where you keep your bespoke razors. Order Weber today, and we'll make sure every month you are freshly resupplied with a hand-picked selection of our finest spiders. That's Weber, the last subscription service you'll ever buy.
And we're back. We move on to segment 2, Wordsworth. In the recurring segment Wordsworth, we either discuss English romantic poet William Wordsworth or assess different words' worth. This week, after a coin flip, we are doing the latter and assessing the worth of different words. Specifically, we are going to each present political buzzwords, phrases, or jargon that we hate, and we're going to make the case that people should stop using them. The rest of us are either going to agree and pile on vigorously or defend the worth of those words. Here's the catch, though. Each of the words or phrases we present have to be used most commonly on the left, because this would not be an interesting segment if we just went around and said right-wing phrases that bothered us. That would just be too many to count. Who wants to begin with words that they feel have no worth?
Well, one phrase that drives me absolutely bananas is the phrase, hate speech isn't free speech.
The phrase is hate speech isn't free speech. Okay. Unpack that, Eli.
So hate speech is a porous term that essentially functions as a linguistic scold and not as any sort of clear or meaningful term. And there's no way to define hate speech narrowly and specifically enough to avoid sweeping up things like criticisms of Israel, which are often deemed anti-Semitic hate speech, or, you know, Black Lives Matter rhetoric, for example, which is often dismissed as anti-police or anti-white. So even though leftists see a difference between the two, it's not an especially clear delineation, and the term hate speech has already been used against the left to suppress the left. So I really loathe that phrase.
Any disagreements or complications or questions?
Is it that we need something else to refer to what people think they're referring to when they say hate speech? Like, which part of this phrase, what's happening here?
There's a couple layers. The first layer is that hate speech is in fact free speech, according to the American Constitution. But secondly, I think that the term hate speech is completely vacuous and conveys almost no meaning. And people use it as if it's a meaningful term that has a very clear, agreed-upon definition, and it doesn't.
So, like, the thing to replace that would be, like,
don't use the phrase.
Like, don't be racist. Rather than saying hate speech isn't free speech, you just say don't be racist. Or don't be whatever.
Racist is also a fairly, you know, I mean, it's also a kind of linguistic scold, and, you know,
don't be a dick.
Yeah, don't be a dick. Okay.
Well, don't be racist is a good phrase. We can't take that away.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not just, yeah. I just think it doesn't really solve the problem of the term hate speech, because it's also similarly debatable what things are racist and what things are not.
So is what bothers you that you invoke this magic word that is hate speech, and then that shuts down the conversation when you think instead people should just argue back?
Sure. I mean, I think that's part of it. But I also think that I just don't think hate speech is a meaningful phrase. So people use it as a sort of sloganeering mantra, and it doesn't persuade anyone who doesn't already agree with you. And it doesn't really say anything either.
Oof. We could eliminate a lot of political language if those are the standards.
I think it's worth pointing out, I mean, there are places where hate speech is an actual, you know, legally defined term.
Right. And there's all sorts of censoriousness that's advanced in the name of that phrase. In Germany, for instance, criticism of Israel is, you know, you think it's a third rail in the United States. It's far more taboo, I would say, in Germany in a lot of ways. In some ways not, but in other ways it is.
So, okay, so Richard Spencer, sorry to invoke this name of this guy who should not be a famous person, but he's going on, he comes to, you know, University of Indiana, and he gives a speech, and it's all, you know, I hate this race, I hate that race. And some kid stands up and says, you know, Richard Spencer was doing hate speech at the University of Indiana. What would you want that kid to say instead?
I don't think he's wrong that Richard Spencer is a bigot advancing racist views. I mean, I guess the particular framing of this is that hate speech isn't free speech. So it's the assertion that it's not protected under the First Amendment, and that because something is hate speech, you shouldn't be allowed to say it. Of course, with criticism of Israel or Black Lives Matter or whatever else, that term can also be used to suppress the speech of leftists. So it's an unhelpful term that holds very little explanatory value. So the question was, how should the kid respond? I think it's okay to say that Richard Spencer is a racist and he's advancing racist views. And, you know, you can debunk his arguments on their merits, which are very, very few. You know, he loves to cite Israel and say that he just wants a white state. If it's not wrong for Jews to have their own state, why is it wrong for, you know, white Euro-Americans to have their own state? And the response to that would be, you know, apartheid is a likely outcome of any supremacist state. And, you know, Israel engages in all sorts of indefensible practices. And that's something that we should not seek to replicate here in the United States.
to make the meta commentary on that without the content of going into this, like the specific Richard Spencer thing, it's you're saying make the argument. Don't invoke some word and stop talking.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I think if you were going to try and define hate speech, probably the easiest way to define it would be like speech uttered in hatred of the person that you are addressing. And I think that then your task would be to be like, is my hatred justified or not? And the thing that's actually tricky is someone like Richard Spencer would never get up and make a speech saying, I hate that race. He would never, ever do that.
Right.
Like, would all be like, oh, well, I want us all to live in harmony. But, you know, like, maybe, like, people get along better around people who look like them. And maybe that's what actually would make us all happiest and be nicest for everyone. So, like, you actually get into this kind of, like, blurry area where, like, you're not actually even trying to like define like the tone or stated intention with which something is uttered. You're actually just making a moral judgment about whether you think the speech is good or bad. And like, you should make that moral judgment, but it's true. Like maybe hate speech is not always a phrase that's helpful. It would depend on whether you had the kind of speaker who was going to get up and be like, I hate gay people, versus the kind of speaker who's just going to get up and be like, well, I don't know, like maybe like two like gender parent households are like more stable for kids, like, and don't we want kids to be happy? Like, so I don't know.
Well, and you've also written an article in defense of Hellfires, and Nathan has written an article in defense of hate, essentially. And I think you make the excellent point, which is that there are some ideas, you know, like injustice, we should hate it. Is it hate speech to rail against injustice? Because if so, lock me up, you know?
We will lock you up. We're going to move on to the next person, but I have to have this little aside, which is that it reminded me of Brianna said, oh, you know, Richard Spencer never will ever just like argue specifically. He'll argue in some circuitous way. I have to plug this amazing New Yorker article that just came out this week about this debate W.E.B. Du Bois had with this super racist back in like the 1900s who wrote The Passing of the Great Race, which was like the book that founded eugenics. And the guy gets up to debate him and he says the Nordics have a specific thing, a mysterious substance called germplasm that all the other races don't have as good germplasm. The Nordics have a superior germplasm and that's why they're the master race. And I just think that there's like a centuries long legacy of circuitous, like rational sounding ridiculousness to defend anything. And it's usually never someone just going out and saying it. So whoever had Nordic germplasm on their bingo card for this episode, you can now cross it off. Who wants to go next with their word that they want to retire? I can go if people want to not go next. Okay, how about I go? I really want the left to properly use the difference between the word movement and the word campaign. Okay. I don't know why I'm so, it's like my greatest pet peeve. A campaign is a specific tactical, you know, strategic effort to do like a concrete thing. So Medicare for All has a campaign. The Me Too idea is like a campaign. You know, passing a certain bill, changing a certain thing, it's a campaign. Movement is like a much bigger umbrella thing that encompasses many campaigns. And it's a, like about an energy on a large scale over a longer amount of time of like moving society in a direction. And I think we overuse the term movement and it devalues it. Like there really should not be more than like, we really can't like hold too many movements in our head.
Important initial question. Should I start referring to my bowel movements as bowel campaigns because they're just like a yes, singular yes. effort? Whereas my That's bowel movement is more my digestive system writ large.
Yes, it would be the okay. like the movement would be this. Like existing.
Okay, sorry, continue.
I just
but is it the bowel battle is a campaign, the bowel movement is a war.
Like the feminist movement, you know, the socialist movement, racial justice movement. And it helps us think, I just think it sharpens our strategic thinking just on the margins. Like, this doesn't really matter, who cares? But like on the margins, it helps us just think a little bit more strategically about what's going on. It's like a movement is a series of campaigns over a long period of time that each, you know, whether they succeed or fail, push in a direction and like change language and patterns of thought and like organizes people into a larger movement. And so I just think we throw out movement way too much. And so I'd like to restore each to their proper place.
Is Me Too an edge case? Because it does seem like it can or does contain several different campaigns.
Or would it be like subsumed by the feminist or anti-violence, intergender-based violence movement?
Yeah, I would say like, yeah, it's either part of the feminist movement or some like anti-violence movement or something like that. And maybe we should come up with a ladder of different things. Like there's campaigns, there's this, there's
that. Yeah, because you know, to me, like a campaign has goals that are specific.
Yes, yes.
Whereas like Me Too, I mean, I suppose the end goal would be an end to all harassment and gender-based violence, but that's like very, very broad. So like I'm not sure if Me Too has like specific goal. Like it might be we want to name, you know, this harasser or this person, but it's kind of in the middle where it's got a specific issue, but it's not necessarily got like a not in the same way as Medicare for All has, like, we get this thing passed, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's like a middle, yeah, it's a middle thing because it like the law, the goal to pass certain laws or something would be campaigns. And I do think it's something to do with our relation to like success existing or not. Like the campaigns need to have concrete goals. It is a failure of the campaign if they didn't achieve the goals, but a failed campaign could help a movement if they're kind of vaguely aligned in the same direction. And like we sometimes like harshly judge movements because they're like, where's the goals? But movements kind of are about like energy moving in a direction, not about achieving concrete things. And so I don't know why this gets caught in my craw, but it does. I'm also bothered by like startups saying we're starting a movement. Like, right. Like I've seen literally like we're starting a movement to like reinvent the water cooler. I'm like, that is not a movement.
No, it's a campaign.
That's a campaign, and it's
campaign
not even
to
a
reinvent the water cooler.
Maybe there's an organic movement that is like a corporate movement about like changing, like a series of like corporate campaigns is like the organic movement or something. But like, whatever. We should know our levels. Okay, who wants to go next?
So mine's not a word, but it's a line. And it's this line that 70% of carbon emissions is caused by 100 companies. Or you see a few different variations on this, that like 100 people are causing 80% of the climate issues or whatever it is. Which really bugs me because the way it's phrased is it has that implication of like, oh, all you need to do is like get rid of these 100 companies or you need to like change, which first of all, some of these companies, it's not like it's one, you know, it's not Joe's Barber, right? It's Unilever or it's some huge conglomerate that contains like a bajillion companies in one thing. And it's also, it'll be, a lot of those will be energy companies, right? Fuel companies, oil companies. And it's not that it's an evil company that's just managed to like monopolize the whole thing. It's like that represents those 10 or however many of the big fuel companies represent all our consumption. And it kind of moves the focus away from it. It almost kind of makes it like an individualized thing. I'm not sure what sort of point it's trying to prove, because if you broke up those companies, okay, then instead of having like 10 big energy companies, you have like 100 energy companies that are emitting the same amount. It's not about how many companies there are, how few companies there are, right? It's about changing our entire energy system, right? So this is something that bugs me.
I mean, I think part of the usefulness of it, or at least the attended usefulness of it, is that it kind of, it locates where the power is, right? And that seems like it is helpful, just to say like there are people making decisions that are kind of like having outsized effects, and we know who they are and where they live. And it's not necessarily just your fault for doing whatever you're doing in your life.
I kind of agree with Aisling, and this is something that also bothers me as well, is there's this sort of ethos or perspective on the left around environmentalism that personal consumption doesn't really matter.
Right.
That because it is all happening as a result of however many fossil fuel companies, energy companies, and so on, we can essentially do what we want, or we don't have to pay much attention to what we're putting in our bodies, what we're purchasing, what we're wearing, and so on. And, you know, it's true that using plastic straws and switching to low-flow shower heads and ceasing to consume meat will not save the environment. And, you know, factory farms, fossil fuel industry, and so on bear disproportionate responsibility for exacerbating climate change. And, you know, we need a systemic change. But I feel like we know that we can reduce animal suffering, for instance, by no longer consuming animal products. And we've had conversations on the podcast in the past and in the Slack about how complicated this topic is and how, you know, there aren't always straightforward answers around these questions. I just think that this line that personal consumption doesn't matter as a result of, you know, the point that Ashley made about 80 companies or whatever it was, it has like a real deleterious effect on leftists thinking about individual consumptive habits. So yeah, I agree with you, Ashley, in short.
It's almost like you need both.
One of my all-time favorite Onion articles is titled something like Nation Assumed Everything Would Just Run on Blue Energy Cubes or something by now. And it's just a whole article of people just being like, the cubes would not hurt, they would only help. And like, you could use the cube for this and that, and it would never run out of energy. And I feel like I love it because it really is emblematic of like a certain way that like people think about energy, which is that like, it must be these like evil people that are making it so we can't have everything we want all the time. And like, there's something in between where like, it is like, to some extent, like agency on the part of people who are only interested in making money. And then it is also that like, if we were gonna like actually save the environment, like, and keep the planet habitable for the species that currently live on it, like a lot of things would have to change about the way we live, probably. And like, actually, it's like the people who are making like the individual consumer and lifestyle choices who are thinking about that big picture, and the people who are like focusing on like, oh, if we just get rid of like these 100 people, like everything will be fine, are not thinking about like, even if you did that, like things would still have to change and it would affect your daily life. And like, nobody actually wants to have to think about that. And they feel like, well, I don't need to think about it yet because like, I'm not even in a position where that would make a difference. But the fact remains that like a lot of things would have to change, and it would include lifestyle changes for like every single person. So, yeah.
So we would need a movement to do
this. Yes, I will. I would call the climate change thing a movement.
But the Green New Deal is a campaign.
A very large campaign.
Large campaign.
Yes.
Okay.
But it spans movements, right? Workers' spans movement, movements. Like labor movement, environmental movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a super campaign.
Anti-imperialist.
I'm gonna bake this a bit.
Yeah.
We're going to see what comes out. I'm going to do some thinking. Sparky and Brianna, do you have your words you want to retire?
I feel like mine is kind of close to retirement already, which I'm really happy about because it's been pissing me off for a long time. Well, so first of all, there are a bunch of things that people on the left say all the time that I just don't understand. Like, I just learned like what praxis means when we had the thing on the podcast of like Leda making fun of people who say praxis in a particular way, things like that. But I think like the thing that really bugs me most, that thankfully I see a lot less of now, is people talking about income inequality. Income inequality, as opposed to wealth inequality, is just like a really, really frustrating thing to me for people to focus on.
Was that a conspiracy? Because it seems bizarre that that's what we landed on. Was that an effort by people to not have us think about inequality generally? Or
I don't know. It would be a great project. I mean, like, you would particularly see it in terms of like the CEO to average worker pay ratio,
yeah,
which is, I think, often a powerful rhetorical point, but it's also just completely, it just completely misses the mark on like what is important in people's lives. You know, your income is the thing that is subject to, affected by, completely at the whim of all of your other circumstances, right? Like, I have a relatively high income, and I also have a relatively high debt load. And so my net worth is negative, right? Like, I'm making, I think, far above the median income in the United States, but I couldn't go buy a car. You know, I can't eat out with abandon or anything like that. You know, versus there are lots of extremely wealthy people with zero income. You know, there are all kinds of wealth that you can have that register as no income at all. You know, maybe you got capital gains, you got whatever else, you got a home, you got several homes, you've got like, you've got a lot of things that are not income, but are just massive, massive amounts of wealth. It's just not a useful way to like measure what is going on in people's economic lives, I don't think. You know, a few years ago, you were hard pressed to find people talking about wealth inequality in terms of wealth inequality. And now I feel like it's more common to be talking about wealth inequality than income inequality, which is good. But we just need to like just get some of the pay gap stuff is relevant, like that's good, but the real measure, the measure that matters, is wealth and wealth inequality. Like, that's the thing we need to be spending, you know, 95% of our time on, I'd say.
I also, you know, there's the income versus wealth inequality, there's also the like how economic inequality translates into power and democratic inequality and cultural inequality, because income inequality also doesn't touch the fact that like a small cabal of people can call up any politician and like affect public policy, and can, you know, a small cabal of people can make cultural, you know, can make more movies made, can have more foundations be created.
Right.
But if you took away their wealth, would they still hold that? Like, this is why I get wary when people talk about like cultural capital, for instance. If you strip them of all their money, I don't know that they, I mean, they may still hold the cultural capital or cultural wealth that you described, but I think that a lot of people wouldn't. Like, their connections would wither up and dry. I mean, you'd have to obviously modify the arrangements of society so that inequality didn't continue just reaccumulating. But I just wanted to push back against that point about cultural.
Well, it depends on what you believe about the world, right? Like, this is kind of the question of the show Undercover Billionaire, right? It's like, are there just people that you can give them like $100 and they can build $1 million business in 90 days?
Of course not.
Is this a thing where like the circumstances to start with determine how much money and power you have? But I do feel like there are like politicians and people who believe the first thing enough that like even if you took away all of Jeff Bezos' money, they would think Jeff Bezos is like an extremely like wise and powerful person such that he did this in the first place. And therefore,
Elon Musk or whatever.
Him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I guess I wasn't arguing that like culture is upstream from wealth. I was just saying that, you know, there's that famous philosophy book by Michael Walzer, Spheres of Justice, which says a just world is a world where you cannot convert one type of power, where it's not easy to convert one type of power into another type of power. And like one of the injustices of our time is not just the wealth inequality, but it's that those walls are completely tumbled down and basically you can become culturally powerful, politically powerful just by being economically powerful. And just was saying, but you know, if you equalize wealth inequality, those walls would probably start coming up again. So I wasn't saying it was upstream, just saying it was another awful consequence of our time. Yeah, I wonder if this is also just like the progressive obsession with tax and transfer as the only method. You know, we just like, we have the golden hammer of tax and transfer. And the only tax we can even, it's not just tax and transfer, it's income tax and transfer.
As opposed to guillotines and just seizing the wealth?
I'm not endorsing that, but okay. I will say as opposed to labor unions.
Okay, yeah, right.
Wealth taxes, property taxes, land reform, regulating the structure of the economy, democratizing capital, you know, changing the structure of education. And we have this one simple hammer that doesn't really change the structure that much. It just kind of takes from the top and gives to the bottom and doesn't like lock in economic equality and bake it in deep in the structure. And so I think income inequality is good for that golden hammer.
Yeah. I mean, and I think like, you know, there are all kinds of understandable reasons why it's a focus, right? It's like understandable. Like, you can see it. It's easy to access in terms of information. It's like how the tax system generally works for most people already. You know, like if you have a job, but you don't have like holdings in a bunch of different LLCs that own a shitload of property all over the country, you understand what it means for someone to make a lot more money than you in their paycheck. But you don't necessarily understand on a visceral level what it means to like have a massive amount of wealth.
You don't understand what it means to take your two models to the MIT Media Lab right. And meet with the head and secretly anonymously right. Give money to change the structure right. Of MIT.
And it's much easier for people, because of the structures that we've set up, it's much easier for people to hide their wealth than it is for them to hide their income. You know, like Jeff Bezos has a $1 income, like his salary as a CEO is like $1, right? Which tells you absolutely nothing about him or anything else.
And it's a lot easier to see people who have a higher salary than you. Like, if you have a low salary, you probably know, like, a doctor or you know your manager, but you probably don't know your manager's 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 manager, right? So it's more visible.
Yeah. And it's not as though income obviously matters. It's just that, you know, you could radically change the distribution of incomes without radically changing the distribution of wealth over hundreds of years. like wealth is just so drastically unequal in a way that I don't, like, incomes don't even come close to, that you're just not. I mean, this is one of the statistics is not totally like directly related, but in Marshall Steinbaum's recent article about student debt and racial wealth inequality, one of the things that he points out is that, you know, there's this huge racial wealth gap in terms of like white people have a lot more wealth than black people, proportional to relative income or relative population size. And like people always focus on the median racial wealth gap, which is like median white family versus median black family. And I think the median white family has like $164,000 in wealth, and the median black family has like $12,000 or $14,000 in wealth, which is a huge gap, and it's really important. But if you're talking about the overall racial wealth, all the money that white people have that if it was equally distributed, black people would rightfully have. I think he said that like 47% of the entire racial wealth gap is just the gap between the top 2% of white people and the top 2% of black people. Like if you completely equalized the bottom 98% of white and black people in terms of wealth, you would only eliminate 53% of the racial wealth gap. The wealth is just so completely concentrated at the top, and like you're just never gonna hit that with income-based reforms.
Yeah, it's like group A pillaged from group B, and then group A split into two groups where a tiny sliver of group A pillaged from the rest of group A.
Right.
While continuing to pillage from group B. And then you say, oh, you know, the only thing to talk about here is A and B.
Right.
Not the slivers.
Yeah. So that's my thing.
Let's move on to Brianna's final words worth or lack of worth. What is a word you want to retire? Word or phrase you want to retire, Brianna?
I have two. I don't think one is worth arguing about. The other one we might argue about for a little bit. So first one, comprehensive immigration reform. It is a completely meaningless phrase that politicians use when they want to say, I would like to signal that I want immigrants to vote for me, but I have no plan. Any Democratic candidate who uses that phrase should be like drowned in a sack. And I'm like so fucking sick of it. Like everyone needs to shut the fuck up. Okay. That one, we don't need to argue about that.
No, agreed.
Comprehensive blank reform. We would not accept that in any other area.
And immigration is so complicated.
Comprehensive health reform. Comprehensive economic reform.
Yeah. So that one, I'm not going to argue about that with anyone. If you want to fight me in the street about it, we can do that. But okay, so there's that. Other one, I've been on this campaign for so long. I've never won. Neoliberalism. I think neoliberalism continues to be a meaningless word. I have like a thing where if I'm editing an essay for Current Affairs, I cut it down to a maximum of one use per article because like I have not been able to persuade Nathan that we should ban it completely from the magazine. But I think that it's like so unhelpful that like we need to limit its use seriously. I think like sometimes it just means conservatism. Sometimes it is just describing a particular phenomenon of privatization. And sometimes it's just talking about like kind of conservative policies under a veneer of like progressive rhetoric, all of which things like kind of have some relation to each other, but not that much. And like on the whole, like the concept is like not coherent and people just kind of use it however they want to use it. Like there was that like Twitter thread recently where someone was like describing like, this is neoliberal, this is neoliberal, this is neoliberal. It was just like a list of things that had no relation to each other. And I get so fucking sick of like just someone being like neoliberal reforms caused this. And I'm like, spell out what reforms you're talking about and what their actual effect was, or like what you were saying means nothing. So there's my rant. I think we should retire it.
Okay. I have some questions. Okay. So I am in favor of the term, but I think that there's value in explaining what you mean by the term when you use it. It can be used as a shorthand, sometimes helpfully. Are you opposed to using the term socialism? And if not, why not? And how is it different from using the term neoliberalism?
I actually don't think the term socialism is incredibly helpful. And I think part of that, like, it is another thing where, like, people don't always agree about what it means. If there was, like, a better term for me to use, I would. Because I think, like, when I say that, like, I'm a socialist, which I didn't start doing until quite recently because it was such a vague term, I'm describing, like, a particular orientation that I think a society should have in terms of what its like purpose is. But like, I don't even know that that's very helpful. Like if someone came up to me and was like, I don't self-describe as a socialist, but they outlined like a bunch of ideas that I thought were good, like I wouldn't give a shit whether they call themselves a socialist or not, because I don't think that term has a whole lot of meaning. So like I agree there are a lot of terms that in politics are sort of vague and don't have meaning that could have like some uses. Like that's definitely true. My beef with neoliberalism is that people use it as if it was an incredibly precise term for a very particular ideology that's like infecting everything. And I don't think that that makes sense because it doesn't have a very specific meaning.
Well, is there a term that you could use to, as a shorthand to describe the current economic policies that were advanced under Obama? And
it's not always about like under Obama. Like it was originally just like this is like the resurgence of like old school liberal economics, which was basically kind of shorthand for like free trade, free market economics. And then it kind of became a weird like, oh, but it's actually about like how privatizing stuff when you're pretending to be progressive is bad. I don't know that people like, I think you could probably use privatization to cover a lot of the things you're trying to talk about. Maybe that's also not a good term. It also kind of is presupposing that the government had like control over certain things as an initial matter that was then taken away, as opposed to many areas of life, at least in this country, where the government never had any effective control over it. And then there's a question of like, should the government be controlling various things? Is that always good? So yeah, I don't know.
Brianna has given us a like entire podcast worth of question to unpack, which is like, I want to have like a whole episode about this, but maybe we can take a couple minutes now to do this. Is it just market fundamentalism, which is, I think, is like a slightly clearer phrase, which is that it's a theory of organizing kind of society that is like a fundamentalist belief in free markets. I will also add a complicating idea, which is that the point where I started to agree with Brianna on this was all these critiques of UBI, which I agree with. I agree with all the critiques, but like, let's pretend you're not indoctrinated by the left yet. And someone was like, okay, I get neoliberalism. I get what you guys are going for. And then someone's like, oh, I just came up with this idea where we tax people and then send everyone money. And then you'd be like, oh yeah, that's great. That's socialism. And then someone goes, no, it's insidious neoliberalism. And then you'd be like, okay, oh wait, I don't get the definition yet. And then you like, you have to understand UBI is trying to do this. And I get that. And I think we all get those critiques of UBI, but like teaching someone about neoliberalism, suddenly the definition starts fraying when it starts getting into these like deep insinuating neoliberalism in all the corners of all these different thoughts.
So I'm going to attempt to define neoliberalism. And I think the problem is, this is a wider problem, especially on the left, where you have a word where I do think it is useful, but then people start using the word as a sort of inherent justification, like it's almost sort of question begging, where if you try to say, why is this thing bad? They'd say, oh, because it's neoliberalism. And it's like, well, that's not an answer. Like, you should, I think, where you can, try and be more specific about why you're saying this or what something does rather than what it is. So I would say that liberalism was a movement or an ideology that combines free market economics with individualized social rights. So a belief that the individual can be, you know, be whatever sexuality they want, or they should be able to live their life in the way they want. And then you combine that with a individualized free market economic system. And then I would say that neoliberalism is an extension of that from the government into all areas of life. And I think Rennick's made a really good point that it's kind of implying that the government like should have those things or always had those things, which is not necessarily true. But I do think it describes the movement of liberalism from being specifically, a government-based political ideology into all areas of life. And then an assumption that that is the only way of life. So there is no alternative, that you cannot kind of move beyond that as an ideology, and you cannot think about alternative structures, and you have to use that in all aspects of your life. I'd say that's what it is. And I agree that like loads of people just kind of use it as inherent justification or use it very loosely. But I think it has a purpose.
So Brianna, wait, I wanted to follow up on this. Okay, another misused and abused term is postmodernism, right? But it refers to a specific period, specific style, and characteristics. And just because people misuse the term does not mean that it's not a useful or important term. And in fact, if you were to ban the term postmodernism and say we shouldn't use it, it would be very, very difficult to know how to refer to the period following the modernist period.
How do we describe Don DeLillo's White Noise and The Simpsons?
I wrote an article shitting on something that I very broadly defined as postmodernist literature, just because I was trying to find some word to encompass like literature I don't like. And someone wrote an entire like literary journal article about how I had used that word wrong and like got it published in some magazine. So I actually don't know that postmodernism is like a very, I think it's, I've used it before. I actually don't think it's a very helpful term at all. because it is, again, like, it's describing both an era, but also like a vague tendency. And like the tendency is like not very clearly defined. So like I am guilty of the sin of like having used that word. But like it actually like...
I love that we were all describing the second most fraught term. And Eli was like, oh, why don't I have the first by describing the first most fraught term in existence?
Can we do a podcast called Neoliberal Postmodernism and then just like lose our shit for like an hour?
What about capitalism?
Fascism.
Is the problem, like, is this feels related to the movement versus campaign question.
Thank you, Sparky.
Can you have a movement toward or against a thing that is, like, satisfactorily defined enough that people aren't just going to be, you know? Like, this is what I thought when you brought up socialism, Eli. It's like, yeah, but can you have a movement for socialism if it's specifically and satisfactorily defined?
Of course. I mean, listen, social sciences, politics, these are all messy things. And we're never going to have definitions that everyone agrees on, but that doesn't mean that we need to throw the terms out entirely. I mean, that's insanity. We have to talk, we have to have terms for discussing politics. And if every time we talk about socialism, you know, we say nationalizing the means of production or democratizing the means of production, there are people who are going to say, well, that doesn't fully accommodate my socialist vision, and so you're going to have to tack this on. And then there are going to be other people who say, well, I'm a socialist, but I think you need to abolish the market. And so if you don't abolish the market, you're not really a socialist. But I think that it's a useful term for rallying around, and I think that it's a useful term for referring to a sort of economic tendency. And of course there's going to be disagreement and argument, but this is how we clarify what the terms actually mean, is through argumentation. And what you want to do is you want to end the argument. You want to say, let's stop debating, let's stop discussing the kind of... I mean, I think socialism, using the term socialism or neoliberalism, helps us identify the enemy, or helps us clarify what it is we're for and what it is we're against. I think that's a good thing.
Brianna, unless you have a response, I'm going to let Eli have the last word on that.
How can I respond to that?
Eli, you remember when that guy founded the Tea Party by being on CNBC, Santelli or something? And he like shouted and he's like, we need a Tea Party in this country. If you take any 30-second clip of you, it could found an entire movement.
Oh my God.
Or campaign. I just want to, yes!
I want a remake of Paddy Chayefsky's Network starring Eli.
I just want to hear you like deciding we should go to one restaurant instead of another.
You're just shutting down the debate.
This has been great. Thank you, everyone. This has been Sparky Abraham.
Adios.
Aisling McRae.
Bye-bye.
Brianna Renix.
Night, everyone.
And our revolutionary leader, Eli Massey, defender of... words.
Peace.
Now I am become Eli, defender of words.
I'm your host, Pete Davis. Good night.
Let's do footnotes. Biphasic sleep is the practice of breaking up one's sleep into two shorter sleeps. For example, taking 2 4-hour sleeps in a 24-hour period rather than sleeping for 8 hours straight. Although the practice is often incompatible with modern lifestyles, it is common in less extreme forms in many cultures, for example in the form of the Spanish siesta, and there is evidence suggesting it may reduce stress and boost cognitive function. The historian A. Roger Ekirk has hypothesized that biphasic sleep was the norm in Western societies before the Industrial Revolution. The morality of babies has been hotly debated since time immemorial. Yale University even has an infant cognition center, or baby lab, which examines the mind and moral philosophy of babies. The position of baby lab psychologist Paul Bloom is that babies do have a sense of right and wrong, but are also highly biased and prone to tribalism. The Tea Party movement was kickstarted in 2009 when CNBC business news editor Rick Santelli performed a rant about the Obama administration's plan to help people refinance their mortgages in the wake of the recession. Santelli claimed the plan was subsidizing losers' mortgages and said America should reward people who can carry the water instead of drink the water. The statistic that 100 companies are responsible for 71% of greenhouse gas emissions comes from a 2017 report from the Climate Accountability Institute. According to the report, The number one emitter is the coal industry of China, number two is Saudi Aramco, and number three is the Russian natural gas company Gazprom. We don't actually have a spider subscription box. We did try to make one, but there was an incident. Thanks to Dan Thorne for editing this episode. Thanks to you, the listener at home, for supporting us. Our theme song is The Gherkin Train by Joe Smith and the Spicy Pickles. I've been Aisling McRae. This has been Current Affairs.